Hey, From the Back Burner podcast is sponsored by Birch Barrel. This grill, I can't say enough good things. I mean, live fire cooking at its best, and what better to use for cooking wild game and meat that you've harvested than fire? I mean, it's awesome. So versatile from cooking, smoking, baking, you name it. This grill literally does it all. I've used mine to no end, and I'm always finding new and creative ways to use it. But if you want to check them out, visit birchbarrel.com. Go onto the website, look at the barrels themselves. They have a lot of extras too, seasonings, knives, you name it. It's really, really cool. They've got their own charcoal now, their own charcoal. Love lump charcoal. It's been something I've used quite a bit in my cooking, and maybe something you can try out for yours. But anyway, visit birchbarrel.com. If you find something you like on there, if you want to make a purchase, use my promo code BURNER, B-U-R-N-E-R at checkout for a 10% discount. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to From the Back Burner podcast. I'm Jonathan O'Dell. I am your host. And it's a unusually sunny day here in Juneau, Alaska. We're still hanging out here this week and kind of just enjoying the weather and the sights and sounds and the food. And I'm going to tell you what, man, it's just been awesome. But I have another special guest with me today. She's kind of always been a fixture around the Pacific Flyway for quite some time, and I had to ask her on because she has a pretty unique and unusual job, but it's super, super fascinating what she does and can talk about with us today. So anyway, I want to welcome Patty Schwallenberg. Patty, welcome to the podcast.
Bonjour, Anin. Bonsoir, Gening, and Dunjiba. Yui, Asanokwe. I am the executive director of the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council. I am an Ojibwe woman from northern Wisconsin, but have been in Alaska since 1992, where I immediately learned of the amendment to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and became involved in making sure the Alaska Natives in Alaska were meaningfully involved in the creation of the Migratory Bird Council and the regulations setting the seasons for the spring and summer harvester migratory birds.
Yeah, so you work on behalf of the First Nations here in Alaska in terms of setting seasons and harvest.
Well, my job actually is to serve all partners of the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council, and I'm just going to call it the acronym AMBCC, because yeah. It's such a long name. But the AMBCC has three partners, the federal government, the state government, and what we call the Alaska Native Caucus, and that's 10 Alaska Native people representing 10 different regions across the state. So I serve actually all three partners, but the Native Caucus relies on me to make sure that the co-management process stays stable and healthy, and to assist them with any regulations that they are interested in pursuing.
Right. Now, so I think what most people are unaware of is, like, a lot of the flyway states, you know, we're all kind of in the same boat together, and so we're trying to set regulations and frameworks, you know, for the Pacific Flyway, Central, Mississippi, Atlantic, and all that. But Alaska Alaska's so big and so diverse and actually has so much waterfowl all on its own that it has its own frameworks for the state. Just like its own package, the Alaska season frameworks, because there's so much going on up here, right?
Yes. And then add in the spring and summer harvest, which is obviously different than the fall winter. And it's mostly Alaska Native people that live in rural areas, and the harvest is strictly for subsistence. So people wonder, you know, why are you harvesting in the spring and summer? That's taboo, you know, that's when they're, you know, breeding and, you know, laying their eggs and nesting and et cetera. But that's the only time the birds are there. And when you live in a small community with no store you know, really no businesses at all. You rely on the land and the and all that it provides for your daily sustenance. So the migratory birds are important because they're the first bird, or excuse me, the first wild food or the fresh food that is available in the springtime. And so people are really excited when the birds come because they've been living all winter on dried fish and dried meat and berries and those kinds of things that they've, you know, gathered during the summer and preserved for the winter months.
Yeah. So stocked and stored up and all that. But that's a, I don't want to gloss over that point. So what Patty's talking about is subsistence harvest, on migratory birds. So this is like a really cool, unique opportunity. I mean, I don't think, you know, many folks in the States, you know, appreciate that whole idea because it isn't something that's part of our, annual kind of hunting cycle, you know, where it's collecting of eggs, of birds. You know, I think we've eaten duck eggs, you've eaten, you know, quail eggs or whatever, but a lot of times those are farmed and, you know, sold at stores or whatever, but these are like wild egg harvest off, you know, wild birds out in the wilderness of Alaska, you know, coasts and interior and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And mostly they're gull eggs or seabird eggs that are being harvested, and there's conservation measures, traditional conservation measures that they take. Like if there's three eggs in the nest, only take one, or, you know, don't take all of the eggs, in other words, so that there's still enough for the future. And they have other strategies, and the subsistence season also has a 30-day closure for the nesting period, so that and the people that are actually doing the harvesting as part of the AMBCC Native Caucus have identified when those times are, because they're the ones on the ground and they know when the 30-day period is that sensitive to the birds. And so then they've chosen those dates for each of their regions, and it's different for each region in the state.
Right. So you were talking about there's a conservation ethic that comes with this egg collection.
Yes.
Now, is that something that's like, is that strictly an ethic, or is that a, you know, is that written in rule or regulation? Like, oh, you know, if there's, you know, is it down to that, or is it just something that is practiced where it's, if there's three eggs, you only take one? Or
it's a practice that has been passed down from many, many generations. It's considered an indigenous knowledge. This is how we manage these birds so that we will continue to enjoy them. And so that's just a unspoken rule, if you will. Uncles pass that on to their nephews, and the aunties pass that on to their nieces, and however the transfer of knowledge goes in other communities. But and the methods and means are different during the subsistence season. There's no shooting hours. There's difference in the ammunition, and the harvest the birds by corralling them.
Okay.
That's not the word, but
yeah,
but they're
like a drive.
Yeah. And the important part of the AMBCC is that the amendment to the treaty stated that the regulations would be based on the cultural practices. And so we make sure that all the regulations that are passed are based on the traditional and cultural practices of the Alaska Native people, even though non-Native people who live in those same communities are eligible to harvest as well.
Right.
So we have a want and waste regulation that is more strict than what normally people would have. We have a handicrafts regulation that allows for Alaska Native artists to use migratory bird parts in their artwork and be able to sell them. So everything is based on the lifestyle, basically, of Alaska Native people.
Yeah. Well, it's talking about food is like one of my favorite topics of all time. I can pretty much do it all day. I mean, I often think as you were talking about that whole ethic, you know, behind something that's kind of handed down. I mean, when I started to learn foraging for you know, why taking from the wild, either berries, fruits, all that stuff, you know, there's this mantra of pick half, leave half, mm-hmm. you know, the wildlife needs it. You got to leave seeds out there. There's, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's interesting to hear that even in, you know, here in Alaska, where, you know, like you're essentially doing the same thing, that this is some, you know, something passed down generationally, mm-hmm. culturally, mm-hmm. as an ethic to be able to say, yeah, we're going to, you know, we want birds to be born so they can come back next year and provide us more.
Yeah.
Eggs, so.
And their survival and the bird's survival depend on it.
Right.
So it's a very much a, reciprocal relationship.
Yeah. Well, and so you were talking about, so, you know, the take of some gulls and all that other stuff, but there's a couple of unique game species, that we've been talking about here this week, a little bit. And one is the emperor goose, that there's take on it, which is really a absolutely cool species in my opinion. You never get to see them down south outside of Alaska, but, but there's as we were kind of walking through some of those regulations, there's the subsistence take from that. And then as well as just kind of allowing, you know, residents of Alaska as well as some non-residents to have some level of harvest on top of that as well, mm-hmm. and kind of working through that. That was super cool. And then you do take on black brant, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
There's like a black brant harvest season.
Yeah.
Subsistence season.
Yeah.
Because those are two species that, you know, unless you're you know, familiar with, or, you know, mm-hmm. close, like you might never see them. I mean, emperor goose season was closed to hunting, public hunting for what, 30 years?
Yeah.
Just recently got opened a few years ago.
And the reason it was reopened is because the Alaska Native people from across Alaska in the harvest areas willingly agreed to not harvest the emperor goose. They chose to close the harvest themselves in their communities. And so then we worked with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Alaska, you know, our partners, and the Pacific Flyway about reopening it, because there were a lot of elders that came to us and said, you know, we haven't had this bird for 30 years and I just would like to have a taste of it again before I, you know, pass on, or maybe we can just have a harvest for the elders. And so they're starting to feel real frantic about the fact that they had willingly stopped harvesting this bird and it's been 30 years and they're like, come on, let's, you know, what's taking so long?
Right.
And so we started doing more intense work on the population models they were using to try to figure out how many birds were out there, and worked with the Native Caucus to identify areas that may have been the birds may be starting to go to now instead of the harvest area, or the areas that were traditionally surveyed by the service. And so the service worked with each of these communities, and we finally reached the threshold where we could have a harvest. And so we in the management plan, we divided it into three areas. So if the population is above a certain number, we call that the green zone, and it's the open harvest. And then there's a yellow zone, and that's where we start initiating conservation measures. And then if harvest goes into the red zone, then harvest stops again.
Right.
And so we did a 5-year management plan and the 3-year trial on the harvest. In the first 2 years, the numbers went down, but then the numbers came back up this year. So I think we're reaching like a sustainable level, but it was only done because the partners were willing to work together, and the service and Fish and Game were willing to listen to the indigenous knowledge that was being provided by the Native Caucus and, you know, take it seriously and start investigating some of the things they were saying.
Right. Now, was there any like habitat work or manipulation that took place to aid in for emperor geese? Like, you know, any work sort of done?
No, but there's a lot of studies that came as a result of our efforts to open harvest that USGS and BLM, I believe, and the Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game too have initiated studies on habitat and survival and nest, you know, survival and some things like that.
Yeah.
To try and understand better why, you know, they're not increasing like they should.
Right. Right. So we've been talking just like, you know, briefly about the subsistence on migratory birds. There's also subsistence on other species though too, mammals and mm-hmm. stuff like that is in there. Because you're obviously so remote. There's not your local grocery store to go pick up.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's everything, you know, muskrats and, you know, trapping and fishing, obviously. And they have traditional fish wheels along the Yukon River and the Kuskokwim River. And they're basically catching fish for the rest of the year. And mm-hmm. so they need an efficient way to get the fish. So they either use nets or fish wheels. And so that's, you know, one of the important resources in Alaska. And then there's, you know, large land mammals and small land mammals. And then, of course, all of the marine mammals species and shellfish, berries, you know, so.
Right.
Devil's Club.
This is, there's a sign actually outside the hotel on the street. I love it. There's a bunch of signs on the lamppost here that say Voices of Juneau. And one of the signs says, you know, we are foragers, hunters, and fishers. And I really that really caught me, you know, right away, just caught my attention. And I was like, you know, that's really, it's something within the hunting and angling community, you know, mushroom hunting, any of that stuff, that for a city, you know, to be able to say that, I mean, like that sign would never appear in like, you know, Voices of Phoenix, mm-hmm, you know,
right.
Like here's the kind of people we are, but it's so much more a way of life and being tied to those activities in the land, for your life, for your lifestyle, for, you know, everything about it. Right. I mean, like there's a few others that are like, you know, we're aficionados of the color gray and we're,
right,
we're water people. And I mean, like all these things that you can kind of attribute to the Juneau, you know, kind of lifestyle and city here. But, it really struck me, you know, as something that, I think, you know, Alaskans can and are proud of, you know, mm-hmm. they certainly can be. And I'm certainly proud of it myself. You know, it's something that I do. I forage, I hunt, I fish, and I think a lot of the folks listening, you know, kind of relate to that as well.
Mm-hmm. There's a saying, at least in the South Central Alaska tribes that I worked with, is particularly right after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and we were trying to get the tribes more meaningfully involved in the restoration process because there was no funding available for human health or psychological issues with this oil spill, because basically their whole grocery store was damaged,
right,
and gone. And so we were at a meeting with the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council trying to get them to understand the enormity of what had just happened. And one of the elders that were with us that was on my board said, for us, when the tide is out, the table is set. And now when the tide is out, there's nothing there for us to eat.
Yeah.
And that's true. You know, they eat seaweed and shellfish and little critters that hang on the rocks, you know, and squid. And, you know, it's a rich, rich environment out there, and Alaska Native people have learned over the centuries to access those in a respectful way and make sure that they're still there today.
Yeah. Yeah. The ocean is just a bountiful harvest,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
like all the time. I've been getting my absolute fill of seafood while I've been here.
Yes.
Shrimp and cod and halibut, and I mean, you name it. It's been like, you know, I live in the desert. And so to trust seafood, you know, I mean, I see seafood in Phoenix and stuff like, oh, you know, fresh seafood. I'm like, yeah, how refreshing is it really? Like, yeah. Like I'm here in Alaska. I'm literally looking at the ocean, you know, like they probably did get this like just a couple hours ago. So,
oh,
you
yeah,
know,
you can spoil up here. I mean, I go anywhere else in the country. I'm like, you know, I don't know about that shellfish or the seafood or whatever, but the lifestyle, the subsistence lifestyle, what they call it, I got firsthand experience with that right after a couple of years after I'd moved up here. I went up to a small village on the Yukon River, and it was in the middle of winter, and I was going to help them set up their natural resource program. So I was working with this individual, and he said, okay, well, we'll see you in the morning. Okay, so the next morning I go to the council office, and there's nobody there. And okay, so I wait around, you know, until probably about 9:30, he shows up. Okay, well, let's get going, you know. So we start working, then about 10:30, he says, well, let's go. I'm like, where are we going? We got to go check the traps. Okay, so we jump on the snow machine. Off we go, check the traps. We come back, work for maybe another half hour. He says, let's go have some moose soup, you know. So we go to his cabin, we have soup, you know. We go back, work a little while longer. We got to go back and check the traps. And, you know, so that's the way it was. Now we got to go get some wood, you know. So there, when we as everyday workers, 9-to-5 workers, are inundating those villages with, you know, we need a resolution, or what do you think about this regulation we're trying to pass, or can you vote on, you know, the results of this survey? You know, they have much more important things that they're dealing with out there. Yeah. Like, do I have enough food for my family, and is my snow machine going to start, and so I can go get wood or whatever, you know. And so we didn't, in my mind, in my perception as a person living in the city, we didn't get much work done that first day.
Yeah.
But in his mind, we were busy all day. We got an incredible amount of work done, you know.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the subsistence lifestyle it's an everyday thing. Like, there's, as you were saying, I mean, there's, to think about, you know, hunting, fishing, foraging for your basic very survival, like, it takes some effort. It may not be all day, but it's every day.
Yeah.
You know?
And you don't get a choice.
Right. So yeah, like the normal 8-to-5 work shift in Alaska, you know, might stretch out quite a bit. Cause yeah, you got to check the traps. Oh, you know, but the energy and effort that you put in, not only to acquiring it, but preparing it, you know, not only just, you know, hey, we're making, you know, a meal for tonight, but you know, you got to think ahead of, you know, okay, we're going to put up so much of this, drying it, smoking it, you know, preserving it for the lean times when we're not going to be able to get this. I mean, there's a lot of energy and effort that goes into that. I don't know that a lot of people, you know, fully appreciate, like, you know, oh, I've got to cook 3 meals a day, you know, like living in the city and stuff like that.
Right.
But, you know, oh, we need more. We can go to the grocery store or whatever, you know, filling your freezer with a big animal like an elk or something like that. I mean, you know, certainly helps, but it's, you know, meal plan, meal prep, you know, thinking through all that stuff. There's, you know, there's quite a bit more effort when it comes to subsistence.
And it's very communal, you know. People will go hunting and then they will share with people who can't go hunting, or maybe people who don't have a boat, or someone who may have lost their husband, or, you know, a widow with kids or something. And so it's, if, like, one village may only have maybe 4 bird hunters, and then they hunt for the entire village.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and I grew up in a pseudo subsistence style life as a kid. I mean, it was, we weren't hunting things for the antlers or to brag to our friends. It was, you know, we were trying to, the rule in our family was, you know, if we're out after deer, elk, or whatever it was, the rule was shoot the first thing that comes in. If a group comes in, shoot the biggest one. Doesn't matter what's on it, but like, look at its size. Because we were trying to feed people. I mean, you know, between my grandparents, my dad and my two uncles, their families, you know, myself, I mean, there was 13 people, you know, that we were trying to do. But I remember, my grandfather, there would be, he lived in a small community in Montana and we had some good years, you know, where we were filling tags, lots of them. And down the road, you know, the old man Johnson, you know, busted his legs, he couldn't get out this year. Hey, go take half this deer down to him, you know, after we'd process. Or, you know, yeah, widow so-and-so, you know, take some meat down to her, get her some burger and roast and stuff. And, you know, so that idea of sharing certainly isn't lost on me. I mean, I kind of grew up in that, you know, that sense of community when it came to the wild harvest and those kind of things. So I can appreciate that. So one of the things I've gotten to try here since I've been in Alaska, I'd heard about for a long time, but I finally got to try it last night, was reindeer sausage.
What'd you think?
I love it. I no lie. we ate it, and I just, like, I couldn't get out of my brain, and I started looking it up, and so I was like, you know, who makes this, and all stuff. So you got the Alaskan Sausage Company, apparently, is, like, the primary of making these reindeer sausages. So we literally had dinner last night. I tried it for the first time. I'm on my phone. I'm looking it up. I can't stop thinking about it. 9 o'clock last night, I ordered a taxi to take me from the hotel to the Fred Meyer's grocery store so that I could buy, I have some packs in my refrigerator right now that I'm taking home with me because I'm super excited about this sausage. It was so delicious. But I'm wondering, are there some, like, very classical or traditional Alaskan wild game dishes that probably the world doesn't know about, but are very common?
Yeah, there are, but they're not, like, widely known. Like, you,
right.
Like, I go to the communities a lot in my job, and so I will go, and then, of course, they cook, and so there's a really, probably very unhealthy, but yummy, yummy dish called halibut a la mac, is what they call it in the Chugach region. And so you put halibut in a baking dish, and then you cover it with mayonnaise, and I think there's some soy sauce in there somewhere, and then onions and cheese, and you bake it. And it's, like, the most amazing.
That sounds delicious. Dish.
They make a seafood salad, but it's with all these little critters, and, you know, and there's shrimp obviously there, but there's this chitin in there, and octopus, and just some really unusual animals that you wouldn't be able to go buy in the store.
Right.
And then they mix it in kind of like a coleslaw-y kind of a salad. Super delicious. These chitin, they cut them up and pickle them, or put them in an oil and preserve them that way in seal oil, and put them in jars, and yum.
Sounds delicious. Yeah, I always find that there's, I'm always on the lookout or the hunt for, like, you know, these kind of relatively unknown dishes or ingredients and stuff like that. I know one of the things that you guys have up here that's pretty rare in the overall, which is birch syrup. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, for those who've never heard or you know, seen this, so it's made from birch trees, much in the same way of, you know, maple syrup is, but very, very unique flavor, and way more, like, there's far less of it produced than there is maple syrup in the world, and so it's very, very expensive per ounce.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, what a, like a super cool ingredient that...
For cooking, yes, because it has a unique flavor. Also, you can tap a birch tree in your yard, like you would a maple tree. You know, overnight, the next day, you take the sap and you just drink it. They call it birch water, and very good for you. You have to drink it within, like, 2 or 3 days or something like that, or it goes bad. But, and it's really good.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's all kind of the typical berries and stuff. I've seen blueberries and huckleberries and, you know, the honeys and all
the
that other
gamut,
stuff.
Yeah. Salmonberries.
It seems like rhubarb has made it up here. Mm-hmm. I was seeing a bunch of rhubarb things the other day in my walk about town and all that.
Yeah, they're in the wild. There's a lot of wild foods that people use and eat too. Devil's Club is one of them.
Yeah. I keep looking out at this mountain that's, like, right outside my room, that's, like, super steep, and I'm very fearful of it because of how steep the grade is. It's a lot steeper than the mountains that I go hike at home. But I'm also, like, really enticed by it. Like, I need to go hike up there and just to walk around and see what's out there in the woods. Cause that's the funnest part for me. I mean, a friend of mine once told me we were out someplace and every morning before work, I would go out hunting, just cause it was like, you know, we weren't starting work until 8 AM. And so I had kind of a couple hour window to go out and just, you know, hunt. And so every day I came back with blue grouse, The next day I had a couple squirrels the next day. Like I just like it, like it was, they would ask me what I was going out to hunt. And I'm like, I don't know. I'll just see what I find, you know? And so for me, it was, he told me, he said, you are the most productive hunter I've ever met. He's like, some days you're coming home with animals. Some days you're coming home with like berries or, you know, fruits or something edible out of the forest. And he's like, you're just like literally the most productive. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's for me, you know, like generalizing instead of specializing, mm-hmm. you know, where instead of, oh, we're going out to do this. I think you don't open your eyes and you might miss everything else that's kind of going on. Yeah. That still might be one of the targets out there, but man, there's like opportunities that jump out at you if you're not paying attention, you know, that you could take advantage of. I mean, you know, we went out on a quail hunt a couple of years ago and I ran across a manzanita bush, that all the fruit had dried literally on the plant, and bears hadn't come and eaten it yet. So I was like, oh, this is really cool. So I, you know, like pulled a Ziploc bag out of my bird vest and, you know, filled it up with a bunch of manzanita berries and stuff. And, you know, or I'll be out and, you know, you might find like a late cactus fruiting. You might find a prickly pear or a barrel cactus, you know, late in the season, December, January, that's got great fruits on it. It's like, oh, I got to get some of those too. So like, you know, ultimately every day I don't necessarily set out to come home with something every day, but that usually is what happens. Like
you probably survive well in Alaska.
I think I would really enjoy it here. I've told people like, I defy you to like the Pacific Northwest of the lower 48. Like I've told people this, I said, I defy you to die in the Pacific Northwest. Like there's so much food on the landscape and you get here to Alaska and realize that it's like that, but on steroids almost. Like there's so much food around you at all times. You just got to have like a little bit of know-how or a little bit of, you know, just to, between the ocean and the land, like, oh my Lord, there's just, you know, there's so much to eat. You could be 800 pounds if you really wanted to. I mean, you'd probably work it off, you know, going to collect it all, but.
They say the average person that moves to Alaska gains 30 pounds.
Really? Yes. I don't doubt that. There's so much good food to eat up here, you know, let alone what you're getting on your own. But, you know, the restaurants here in town are phenomenal with some stuff.
Oh, yeah. And I came from a place where, you know, we didn't have salmon. We had freshwater fish, you know, and right. So we would get canned salmon, but it'd have those little round backbone pieces in there, you know, and it was yuck, you know, I didn't like salmon. And I moved up here and found it. There's like 5 species of salmon and they're ranked and this is the best one. And so over 30 years, you know, you start eating salmon, you become kind of like a snob. You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly like when you're eating the best of salmon possible on earth. Yeah. I mean,
like
some stuff.
Chum salmon. Ooh.
Yeah. Well, I definitely won't invite you out to seafood in Phoenix when you come down there because I know it's probably not up to par by the Alaska standards. So right. Now I got you good right there.
Yep, like
we can make that work. So, but yeah, it's just really surprising that I don't know how many folks out there, like, that's why I wanted to have you on. Cause I don't think, you know, many people know about, you know, what goes on up here. It's, you know, the last frontier as far as it's, you know, concerned and stuff, but there's a very strong, working relationship with the tribes and everything else. And just how this, the largest state, you know, functions and works and operates in its own kind of sphere a little bit.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and especially with so few people, you know, I mean, it's the densities of people are not super great. I mean, you have Anchorage, you have Fairbanks, you know, you have your kind of your urban centers, but, you know, across the landscape, I mean, you can be way out in the middle of nowhere, like those TV shows that they have about, you know, Life Below Zero or, you know, some of those goofy
ones.
That's
so funny, yeah. Some of them they're not very far out of Anchorage. Yeah.
Are they believable? Are they believable at least? Or are they pretty dramatized for like reality TV?
They're dramatized. And some of the things they do, I really don't think people are that ignorant.
some things are just doing for TV ratings.
I think so. You know, it's that's not the average Alaskan. Let's put it that way.
Right.
They're much smarter.
These are the below average Alaskans is what you're saying?
These are the people that came up for an adventure and are learning by doing, I think. I mean, that's my perception.
Right.
I'm sure I'm offending out thousands of people, but.
No. No, it's, I just, you know, getting to see this for the first time, like I am just like overly impressed. I get to hear about it a lot, obviously, you know, and you come down and visit us down in the States for some of the meetings. And I get to hear about this a lot. And it just occurred to me that I was like, man, I bet you there's hardly anyone, you know, kind of knows about this. This is, you know, this is really cool what you do, you know, and the ability to work with us. And of course, subsistence hunting, like to me, that's just kind of the ultimate, you know, if you were to take, you know, probably the purest form of hunting and fishing, like there's a lot of people who would like to hunt and fish, you know, like for all their meat resources for the year and do all that stuff. But a lot of us can't get there, but you know, here in Alaska, like it's happening every day for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm blown away. Like, you know, and I think the egg harvest is cool. Like I never get to go out and harvest wild eggs, you know?
Yeah.
Would love to try that someday. I don't know how or when or whatever that would do. Love to just see it and take part in it. Cause I think that's probably one of the coolest, foraging things, mm-hmm. you know, that you could do. So
it is pretty incredible. And the materials that the Alaska Native people use in the handicrafts, like there's in the Alaska Native Medical Center, they have a lot of art displays in Anchorage, Alaska Native artwork in these glass cases and in inset windows and every floor. And there's one of all baskets, and there's a basket in there that has little bird claws. It's a grass basket, hand woven, and then all these little bird claws interwoven in that basket. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
Yeah, I've been blown away by a lot of the art now. I know that I've been walking past, like, you know, a lot of the touristy shops where it's, you know, kind of commercial mm-hmm. produced stuff. But there's like Sea Alaska Heritage just around the corner.
And
I mean, just a lot of cool stuff. Art-wise, you mm-hmm. know, and the use of natural materials, like, you know, moose antlers and mm-hmm. bones and
whale bone and sinew and
it's so incredible.
The ivory carving and whale baleen and the materials are different than what we would use in the lower 48 for artwork.
Yeah.
And it makes it even more unique. And
but some of the, I mean, like the intricacy of the carvings that I've seen.
Oh, heck yeah.
Like this isn't just like rough hewn, like the level of detail that some of these artists have are just incredible. Like I'd probably break it, you know, if I was trying to do it myself. I'm, you know, I've got big meat hooks and stuff and not as delicate or fine as, you know, don't have the fine motor skills to be able to pull off some of the things that I've seen up here that I'm sure take just tons and tons of practice. But I haven't seen any of the feathers yet, like you were talking about, for use in art that's for sale and things like that.
You may be able, that's a good question. They do make dance fans with feathers. Mm-hmm. Dance masks that sometimes have feathers on them. Before the handicraft regulation passed, allowing that use of migratory bird feathers and other parts, non-edible parts, they were using like turkey feathers, and they felt that that was disrespectful to the mask or to whatever it was they were making, because they weren't able to use the pieces that were supposed to be, you know, in those pieces of art.
Right.
And so it was a really big success to get that regulation passed. But actual pieces of art now are that have migratory bird parts are kind of hard to find because non-Native people cannot sell them to non-Native people. Only Alaska Native people can sell them to non-Native people. So many of the shops are owned by non-Native people.
Oh, okay.
So there's not a place for someone to go where they can...
Right, where that's happening.
You know, where that's happening.
Yeah.
You know, there's a process, you know, if you wanted to buy one, you know, and to prove that it's made by an Alaska Native, if it's like in a consignment type shop, that would work. Then they have to have what's called a silver hand emblem attached to it. And that's a program of the state of Alaska that certifies that it was made by an Alaska Native artist.
Okay.
And so then that satisfies the enforcement portion of that regulation.
Right.
So if you can go to a shop where they sell consignment items, so an individual artist can just go put his piece there and they would sell it for him or her.
Right.
That would be where you could get them, or from just an individual artist that you know.
Right.
But like these gift shops down here, probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's I'm kind of floored by the amount of jewelry stores in Alaska.
I rarely take the opportunity to walk up and down the streets here, you know, because usually I come here for my meetings and then I go. And so I did walk last night and I felt like I was walking down a street in like Mexico, you know, like Cabo San Lucas or one of those ones that has all the jewelry stores, you know, jewelry store after jewelry store after jewelry store. And that's what it reminded me of. And it makes sense. I mean, they're catering to the cruise ship people.
Yeah. Well, and the cruise ships, I mean, holy Lord, like, you know,
they're huge.
Oh, well, yeah. So first of all, they're huge. And there's like three of them out in the dock,
yeah,
like every day. But here's the thing. They show up early in the morning and dock, and then all the people get off and they flood the streets. Like sometimes it's hard. It's super crowded to walk down the streets here, and they're hanging out. And then like everybody gets back on the ship and then they leave, you know, late at night. And then a new ship shows up and it's like whole new people. And so like every day it's like, man, there's like rush hour traffic when we're trying to go eat lunch down here.
And you can kind of tell which ones they are.
Right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, they're certainly not walking with a purpose. Like, we're trying to get to lunch, and we're headed to we don't want to wait in line all day for fish tacos or something like that, you know? Yeah. Just super impressive. But, yeah, like, I've never been on a cruise, but now after seeing, you know, the effects here in Juneau, I'm not sure that I'm gonna end up taking one. I'm like, that's just a mass
of
people.
Kind of
it's a whole city
too, so I don't know if I can handle that many people in one location and I can't go anywhere,
yeah,
to get away.
Well, if they had a cruise that allowed me to fish off the back of the boat, like maybe that might be.
And it was a big area that only allowed a few people at a time.
Right.
No combat fishing.
Yeah, we can just troll using the cruise ship. That would be fun.
Fish on.
Slow the boat down. I gotta reel this in.
I got dinner. Oh, speaking of which, I have to tell you this funny story. When cruise ships were going in and out of Prince William Sound and Lower Cook Inlet, you know, they come into Anchorage. And they were coming along Lower Cook Inlet in one of our villages. A couple of their hunters were out there and they were hunting for seal. Well, they got one. And, you know, yay, you know, we got it and we're reeling it in. And this cruise ship is going by and the people are like horrified. And so it's a big headline in the paper, in the Anchorage Daily News, about the subsistence hunting in front of the cruise ship and how terrible. And I'm like, what a unique opportunity. Why didn't they put a different spin on it and say, we got to see actual subsistence harvesting going on right in Alaska? You know,
yeah.
But it was like this, oh my God, they're killing the seals.
Yeah, it's sometimes there's no accounting for people, you know. I'm not sure. Yeah. After seeing all the people on the cruise ships, it doesn't surprise me that that was their reaction, but, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I just tell them keep subsistence hunting in front of cruise ships. Maybe the cruise ships will have to take a different route around or something.
There you go. They're all celebrating their little skiff, you know. Meanwhile, everyone's all horrified in the huge cruise ship.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh, it was funny.
Well, Patty, I have a question for you. By far, what is your... I know you were telling me about the halibut a la Mac, but do you have another like favorite Alaskan wild food?
Oh boy, that, like, that's tough.
Is that your?
Yeah, there. If you can get, well, king salmon or red salmon are the better ones to use, and you only half smoke it. And then once it's half smoked, then and the skin is still on. It's like cut into strips, the fish, and then they're cut so almost like there's little cubes in a way. So when you hang it, you know, all the parts of the fish can dry.
Right.
So you're gonna only half dry it, so it's not gonna be completely dry. It's gonna be kind of uncooked and mushy on the inside, or soft on the inside. So then you take that and you put it in a baking pan again. And soy sauce and Lee and Perrin's sauce.
Oh, yeah, Worcestershire.
Worcestershire.
Yeah, there you go.
Lee and Perrin's.
Now, I went to England, and they told me the pronunciation in England, which is where this sauce comes from, is Worcester.
Really?
That's it. That's the pronunciation.
I'm
Worcester
say
sauce.
That from now
Worcester
on.
Sauce.
I read that and I go Worcestershire or what?
Yeah, they literally say it's Worcester sauce. That's it. It's Worcester sauce.
Okay, well, that's what it is then. So you take that and the soy sauce and you put that on there and probably I think you put some olive oil on the bottom, and then you can put some. Slice onion ring kind of things on the top, and then just bake it for like a half an hour, I think, and serve it with rice. Simple,
yeah.
No seasonings, not your gourmet restaurant strategies here to cook. It's simple, but it is delicious.
That sounds
that
really
fish
good.
Just melts in your mouth.
Got a little bit of the smoky flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And half smoking, half drying.
I had for breakfast when I was in one village.
Nice. Well, that's a solid breakfast. You could do that for breakfast almost every morning, maybe.
Oh, yeah. Fish, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then there's another a snack that they, some of the people, they dry halibut. So it's dry. And then... dip it in seal oil and eat it that way.
Really?
Yeah. You have to have a taste for that, though.
Yeah.
Seal oil is kind of an acquired taste.
Yeah, I've heard it's not something that you kind of jump right into, but it's got a lot of uses.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Well, Patty, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast with me today.
I enjoyed it.
And this is your first podcast, so like now, yeah, like, you know, we... You're much more relaxed now. You were so tense in the beginning. Like, oh my gosh, this is super easy. I'm like the easiest podcast host ever.
You are.
We just make it easy. So anyway, we appreciate you, Patty. I appreciate all you listeners out there as well. Thanks for joining us again today and look forward to talking to you on the next one.
Great.
Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.